Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Tanya Jeffries and Angharad Carrick. And coming up, the state pensions underpayment saga continues. HMRC taking an age to answer your call. It's probably because you aren't important enough. Thanks for nothing, FCA. If you're fed up with insult savings accounts, well, it's on you to find a better one. We explore your rights with mandatory tipping, and Bitcoin surpassed its 60K. What's behind the surge? Could it soon hit an all-time high? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the debacle over the widespread errors in the state pension that This Is Money and Sir Steve Webb uncovered continues. As of the end of October last year, DWP had paid out just under £500 million to more than 80,000 people who'd been underpaid. But what about the rest? What about those who've died? Well, you received an email from a daughter who received a letter from DWP in July 2023, 3 years after her father passed away aged 100. Now, it said he was entitled to more pension than was paid for 20 years up to his death. She filled out the relevant forms and is still waiting for a response, or was still waiting for a response. Naturally, the department that deals with this doesn't take calls, so she got in contact with This Is Money and Sir Steve Webb. Tanya, welcome. And before we dig into this specific case, just remind us of the background to this first, if you would.
In early 2020, Steve Webb had a message to his inbox from somebody whose wife had been affected by an underpayment. And we started investigating. And as a result, more and more women came forward and we discovered they'd been underpaid. The investigation got bigger and bigger. It snowballed and the government eventually announced a massive exercise. It's called the LEAP exercise in their jargon. And it's an attempt to systematically pay all the people who should have been getting more in state pension in the first place. Now, there's lots and lots of subgroups of people who have not been paid the correct state pension. We discovered more and more of them as time went on and helped them. But the three groups of people that this LEAP exercise is specifically directed at, and which this lady's late father was affected by, is it's married women on a low state pension who should have got an uplift when their husband reached state pension age. And it's widows who should have got an uplift when their husband died. And the final group is people who are over 80 who get a basic state pension of about £94, I think it is, £94, £95. And that's just based on age and a simple residence test. The reasoning being, I assume, that people who reach that age should at least get some kind of payment to keep them out of poverty. So, yes, it seems like this lady's father missed out on it for 20 years. And he was on pension credit. So in that situation, because he would have not received pension credit if he'd been getting the correct pension, they balance it all out. So she got in contact with us because she got this letter. It didn't say how much her father was owed. She was left completely hanging in terms of, you know, what this 20-year underpayment represented, which must have been really galling, because what might go through your mind as to how much you're owed at that point? We got to the bottom of it, obviously. They found her payment. But one of the problems was, I mean, we've been doing so many stories with the state pension top-ups, as you know, and we've had endless complaints about how difficult it is to get through to the DWP. But the people who are affected by this, even when they've had a letter, have got an extra layer of difficulty because they just get through to the ordinary staff. But the specific department, which is sorting out the underpayments, doesn't take calls from the public. And you can kind of see why. We want them to get on with working out what people are owed and repaying them. But it does mean that when people have been lost in the system and left hanging for, you know, 7 or 8 months, they don't seem to get any help. And there didn't seem to be any sort of let's pass the message on to this team. If they did, nothing happened. Well, within a few days of us getting in touch and raising a case, needless to say, they found this money. We are probably going to take it further, though, because we have had several new cases in since we published this of people who have similarly been contacted with a vague letter saying you or a deceased relative was underpaid, and fill in this form, and then they've heard nothing more since. I mean, it's a legacy issue of the main problem. But it is really upsetting for people who have been done out of this money through no fault of their own. And as always, it's a bit unequal because some people could have really used this money and some people, they obviously deserve the money. In principle, they should definitely have the money, but it didn't necessarily impact on their daily lives. I think this is one of the cases where the money would have made a huge difference to this lady's parents. That is incredibly upsetting. It leaves bitterness, and the fact that they then couldn't even sort it out at the end to give her the money in a timely fashion. Well, it's a disgraceful state of affairs, really. And I think that if there are more people out there who have been contacted and then left hanging in this way, then, well, we're going to campaign on that and take them to task and make sure that nobody's getting left behind in this. Not everybody is going to contact This Is Money. A lot of people are going to either carry on phoning the DWP or, worse still, give up and never get the money. So that's the situation, and that's what our plan is, to take it forward now.
Not on, is it, Lee? I saw you nodding vigorously there when Tanya was saying about the hardships that things like this cause.
I think it's absolutely disgraceful. There's a number of reasons why I think this is disgraceful in the way that this has come about. So first of all, I should point out here that we caught up with Steve this week, Tanya and I. We met up with Steve and talked through all of the fantastic work that both he and Tanya do in the world of pensions and keeping banging the drum on all sorts of different issues. And the amount of work that goes on behind the scenes to make these things happen is vast. And we were talking about, you know, this person had passed away at 100. They'd obviously had a fit life, you know, had managed to stay healthy and whatnot, but they're never going to have benefited from that extra money that was rightfully theirs. And I think that's what always leaves a kind of bitterness in the mouth. Number one is that person whose money it was didn't actually get to use it. And it might have meant that they cut back in ways in their life in which they might not necessarily needed to do. And the other thing to mention of this is the way that these cases are being handled. Listen, it's complex. We understand that. And the correction exercise is taking time. We understand that. We're fully aware of that. But I think to get in contact with someone to say, you know, your now deceased parent is involved in this. And Tanya mentioned it at the start. A lot of these cases are underpaid women. But in this case, it was a 100-year-old man. You know, so it doesn't discriminate what's been going on here. And it's just the fact that it's kind of like, here's a letter. It's likely that your now deceased parent is owed money. And then it almost ends it all with a dot, dot, dot. You know, what next? You know, it kind of like, it's just left hanging like a cliffhanger. Yeah, you don't know how much the payment is. You don't know when you're going to see it. You don't know what's going to happen next. And, you know, naturally, you would get straight in touch. I think anyone would. They would want to know, well, hold on, are we talking hundreds? Are we talking thousands? Are we talking tens of thousands? How has the situation unfolded? It leaves a lot of kind of questions unanswered. And then the way people are having to chase it up constantly to try and find out what's going on, it's just not on. Why does it have to take us to step in and say, hold on a minute, you know, we're talking 6 months later and this person is none the wiser still. We still don't know what side. So look, as I say, it's complex. There's a part of the department that's dealing with it, and we know this extra staff that's been taken on to deal with this, or extra staff that have been moved around to deal with this. But it's still wrangles, Georgie. There's still these elements that are kind of frustrating.
Oh, of course there are. Tanya, I mean, I assume everyone can't get in contact with This Is Money as much as you can try and help people. There's a lot of people who have been affected. So if this is you and you're in a situation left hanging, what do you do? Like, who do you call? What do you say? What have DWP said to you about this?
Well, their response to this one was they did apologise for the delay. They said that out of all the people they pay state pension to, there's a 0.5% error rate, which does sound very low, but until you work out how much that actually represents in terms of money and what an incredible difference it makes to people's lives if they're between being paid correctly and being paid incorrectly, and especially when we're talking about thousands or tens of thousands of pounds. In this instance, I think do contact us. Obviously, keep contacting the DWP and try and insist that they pass the message on. But I think that if they've left a lot of people hanging, we need to push this. I've got some cases already. We've had some from people who have literally just received a letter or have done so in the last month. I think you have to give them a bit of time. I mean, I think you have to give them a couple of months maybe. But anything from late last year onwards is pushing it a bit, I think. Certainly 3 months is the outside edge, I think, of how long you should wait after receiving a ... watch this space as Lee called it. And so get in contact with us, pensionquestions@thisismoney.co.uk. We really cannot promise to help everybody, but we will take as many cases as we can. The other option is always to contact your MP, and we've been pushing this a lot in our top-ups campaign as well, because it's not just a matter of getting your MP on side to help you individually, but the more you raise the profile of problems like this at Westminster, and the more questions they get from their own colleagues or, you know, opposition MPs saying what the hell is going on here, the more the pressure rises. I mean, we can't do it on our own. Some political pressure is really helpful. We are very lucky that we've had politicians help us. Ros Altman has been staunch, and also Wendy Chamberlain of the Liberal Democrats has been very supportive, and she put a question in just this week asking about the working of the government IT systems and where they're falling down on this kind of thing, particularly with top-ups. So we are doing our best to force the government really to take a long, hard look at the way they're administering pensions, because it just has such an outside effect on the individual people. Saying 0.5% error rate, maybe they think that that's comforting to people. It's not comforting to people, because it can be such a massive deal if you're in that group of people.
Quite. Let's stick with the theme of HMRC and staff. So Steve is calling on DWP, HMRC, to get in more staff, not necessarily over this issue, but there's another issue that they're having to deal with, Tanya, and that is the complaints of state pension top-up fiasco. Government is getting ready to launch a new online service next month. Government, online service, IT systems, anything like that sends a shiver down my spine, I have to say, Tanya. But remind us what this is about.
Well, we've been campaigning on this for, it's now an entire year. At the beginning of last year, there was a really big rush of people trying to buy state pension top-ups because there was a really important deadline coming up. People don't need to worry about that so much right now, because the deadline ended up getting pushed back twice and it's now another whole year away. But the importance of that was that lots and lots of people bought top-ups, created a massive backlog, which is still now causing problems a year on. I mean, I had another one just in the last 24 hours. Someone paid £3,300 last spring, can't get any information out of the government about it, money's disappeared, and saying, what can I do? Well, I mean, we've helped so many people do it. And when we flag the cases, they do find the money eventually, although there's a couple that we've covered in stories that we're still waiting for them to sort out now. And as I say, we are trying to get people to complain to us, but complain to their MP at the same time. Basically, send them the identical letter if necessary. But in our latest story on this, which is at the top of the pensions homepage at the moment, Steve Webb has given some very useful tips about getting your letter noticed by your MP and acted on. A lot of it's very sensible stuff, but some of it is things that people won't have thought of. I urge anybody who's writing to their MP about any subject, to be honest, to go and read his tips. He's been on the inside. He's received Yes. He's received plenty of letters from constituents over the years, so he knows what he's talking about. With the top-ups, this new system that they're launching, and they very carefully said it's going to be by the end of the financial year. So we presume they're going to be doing some soft launch at some point between now and the 5th of April. And from what we can tell so far, they're still testing it, but it will be a checking which years you can top up, which ones are worth topping up and actually making the purchase, which all sounds really great, but it could create another situation like last year if they're not careful, because there's probably some pent up demand because people are waiting for the new online service to buy top ups. So a lot of people will rush to use it, but it's not just a matter of buying the top ups and then everything's sorted. There's a lot that goes on after that. The payments need to be processed. The national insurance record needs to be updated by HMRC. And then the case is sent over to the DWP, which recalculates the state pension. It either recalculates the forecast, if you're not state pension age yet, or your actual payments. And that's one of the areas that's caused real problems, because when people are past state pension age already and they've paid thousands of pounds and nothing's happened, then they end up having to get lots of arrears. When by the time they come to us, we get them huge arrears payments. The latest one we got for this lady for this story was £800. I mean, that's a lot of arrears to wait for. So we'll have to see what happens. I'm not willing, to condemn it before it's even launched. I very much hope it's going to make things easier. But the reason that Steve is asking, how many staff are on this and if they're adding more, is because we can see the prospects for another rush and people getting stuck at the I've already made my purchase, what now stage? And then in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year's time, we're still getting emails from people saying, what's happened to my money? It's disappeared.
Mm. All right, Tanya, thank you so much for that. And thank you for being so patient and waiting there. It's like being on the phone to HMRC, isn't it? Which is where we're going next, because we're not very happy with HMRC customer service, are we? We're waiting a very long time. And little did we realise, though, it's our fault. We're not important enough, Ang. We're not important enough, because there is actually, I love the name of this, PD1. It's a fast track helpline which answers your calls 9 times quicker, and it's just for VIPs. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's right. So this week, the Public Accounts Committee put out a report about HMRC and the customer service that has completely deteriorated. Unsurprisingly, we've been writing about this for about a year now. So the recent figures that they put out showed that we are waiting about 16 minutes, which is up from 12 last year, which to me doesn't sound that long to wait. And since we put out the article, we've had so many readers get in touch to say, you know, they wait hours and hours on the phone every day just to get through to a human. It then emerged that there was this VIP lane for certain customers called the PD1 helpline, reported by the Times, where customers wait just 2.5 minutes. And I think that went down to about a minute in November. This is a helpline for, I think, what they call high profile earners or high income earners. And there are 9 call handlers specifically on this helpline, while the rest of us have, I think, about just under 20,000 customer service people, which sounds like a lot, but there are millions and millions of taxpayers who just want to be able to pay their taxes and do it in the right way, kind of, especially ahead of all the deadlines. So the people that have access to this are, as far as I can tell, kind of primarily civil servants and ministers, and presumably other kind of high profile earners. So maybe the likes of kind of, I don't know if the Prime Minister needs to get in touch about his tax affairs. And the rationale that they give is that they can't use online chatbots because of security reasons, which is understandable, but you know, if it's not good enough for ministers, then
but
I don't...
our security's like all right to be compromised, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, fair. Good to know. Thanks, exactly. HMRC.
And I think, you know, given all of the issues that people have had with customer services at the tax office, you know, the fact that, that these people get the luxury of actually speaking to someone, and that that is, you know, being hailed as this huge thing, doesn't really make any sense, because the rest of us don't, and we're all moved on to online chatbots as part of this kind of Making Tax Digital program.
Lee, I see you're shaking your head there.
It's I'm sort of smiling and kind of giggling a little bit, because I just have images of this like special bit of the tax office where it's sort of gold walls and a gold telephone, and it's got its own little ringtone, and there's someone that's very jolly picks up the phone. Hey, you've forgotten your government gateway. No problem at all for you.
Yeah,
you're
quite.
VIP. Whereas, you know, Mrs. Miggins is on a phone on a different room. Oh, I don't know my government gateway. Well, what was your brother's hamster's favourite film? What's the 14th character of that? You know, I could just imagine.
Oh, no, she's still going through press one for something or other.
Yeah. What is
your government gateway to get through to us? But I can't remember my government gateway. Dystopian kind of Kafkaesque nightmare.
It's become, I think getting in touch with the tax office has become a very difficult endeavour. Lots of us have been pushed towards using chatbots. People don't really want them. They don't really answer. Quite often, it's going to be quite a complex thing that can't really be tackled by a chatbot, something very kind of individual to yourself. We've had it in the last year where they've shut down the phone lines at certain points of the year to try and force people to go online rather than get onto the telephone. And of course, more of us are facing tax bills than ever before. Mm. I mean, fiscal drag is pulling us into sort of, you know, all sorts of areas of tax in which we're getting confused and we want to speak to a human. We want someone in a tax advisor in a HMRC to tell us what on earth's going on. And if we can't, it's so frustrating. It's frustrating in any walk of life when you're trying to speak to someone on the phone. And it might be quite an urgent query or something you just want to get sorted like as soon as you can. And then you can't get a hold of HMRC. I think it's absolutely disgraceful.
They say here an average callie is 16 minutes, 24 seconds. Average. Mm-hmm. I don't believe a word of that.
Well,
16 minutes it takes to get through. Get out.
Does that include drop calls? Does that include people getting fed up and hanging up? You know, and all that kind of stuff probably helps change the figures around. But what we hear... Aang has been on top of this for the whole kind of fiasco. And what we hear is typically people say they're waiting 45 minutes to an hour. Now, I guess that it just depends when you phone. You might get lucky. You might get you might just hit it at the right time. But when is the right time? We don't know. I don't know. I can't tell you. Is there? If you phoned at 4:15 on a Thursday afternoon, that is when you're going to get through quickest. It's impossible to know. It's just a complete crapshoot, isn't it, of what you're going to end up getting. And as I say, this has been in the crosshairs of various sort of ministers and whatnot who have kept an eye on this. And, you know, basically the chair of the committee was saying that essentially 8 years have gone since the challenge HMRC over telephone lines. You know, how long people are held. And Dame Meg Hillier, MP, said here, almost 8 years have passed since our committee challenged HMRC over its telephone lines, holding message being one of the most streamed pieces of music in the country. I mean, that is just a phenomenal quote, isn't it? And it's but you ask people in the street, they'll just say it's a symptom of broken Britain, the fact that you can't get hold of someone at the tax office. It's not like we want to speak to
do the right thing to pay your taxes.
And the majority of people in this country, all they ever want to do is do the right thing, and they don't like the feeling of perhaps a tax bill hanging over them, or needlessly paying tax, or being put into an emergency tax, or, you know, it's all sorts of reasons why you might need to get hold of HMRC, and it should not be as frustrating a process as what it currently is. And I think what wrangles with people is something like that VIP lane. Yes, it makes full sense that there would be a kind of VIP lane in terms of there's potentially people that shouldn't be wasting their time, but then you cut the argument is, but I don't want to waste my time, so it's very hard. It wrangles with people. They go, oh right, so, you know, I'm just a regular person that pays taxes, but these people over here get to use the VIP lane. I'll give it one more week until that VIP lane telephone number is leaked somewhere and it gets overwhelmed. don't be surprised.
Aang?
Yeah, I think also that there's a real issue. As Lee said, you know, more people are paying tax than ever. You've got these new changes coming to the self-assessment where, you know, people have to publish their kind of quarterly returns for sole traders. And, you know, in the next few years, it's going to be income over 50K and then 30K. So that's more and more people that are going to have to, you know, do their tax returns four times a year. And they've closed two of the helplines. It doesn't make any sense. And I think so many it will stop so many people from, you know, thinking about setting up a business, going, actually, do you know what? I don't know if I can deal with HMRC. I actually spoke to a reader a few months ago who said that she just wanted to register her business for VAT. And she had moved here from India and she was really excited because, you know, the UK is a great economy. It's a great place to live and set up a business. But the process took so long that she was genuinely considering moving to Dubai because it was just so much easier. It was cheaper, didn't have to pay as much tax, obviously. But it was her experience with HMRC that really made her reconsider staying here. And I think the report this week kind of just shows the scale of the issue, like the sort of state pension stuff that Tanya was talking about. And it's not just the kind of official figures. There are, you know, submissions from official bodies, taxpayers, accountants, and they're all saying the same thing, that they're just fed up. Nothing works. So I think, you know, the closure of the helplines last summer and then again in December, I get that they want to put, you know, have more people online, but you have to make the chatbots better in that sense, or hire more people, train them better. I think that's the only way that we can kind of move forward from this, because people just want to speak to real people.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley Direct for our Investing Explained feature. Lisa, we've got a question from a listener here. Will I be able to access my pension at 55? They said, I've saved hard to be in the position to retire at 55, but the age at which people can access their pots is due to rise. I was born in January 1973 and understand I may be just the right side of the cutoff. Can you tell me if I am, please?
Firstly, well done for saving so hard that you are in a position to be able to stop working when you're 55. The key date is the 6th of April, 1973. If you were born before that, it's 55. If you were born after that, it's now tied to the state pension age. So at the moment, it's 57. But if the state pension goes up, it's 10 years before the state pension age. You don't have to use pension assets to support yourself. If you have other assets in an ISA, in a savings account, or in an investment account, you can use those to cover yourself for the years until you can access your pension at 55, if relevant, or 57, if relevant.
And is it that after that cutoff point, it goes from 55 to 57? It doesn't gradually step up between the two?
No, it's a cliff edge. It goes straight from 55 to 57. At least we got some notice of that, and we can plan accordingly and save outside of a pension if you want to cover for the couple of years. But I love a pension. I love the tax relief. So I'm always going to encourage people to save in a pension.
Lisa, thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. This week, the FCA launched a £600,000 campaign to encourage savers to shop around, placing responsibility firmly on us to ditch our insult accounts and find a good deal ourselves. And this is Money asked the watchdog if it would require providers to improve rates on old accounts, and it said no. So much for the new consumer duty rules. So if you rush to sign up for a great one-year fix at the end of the tax year in April, last April, it is time, says Lee Boyce, to act. Lee, I thought we had new consumer duty rules that would be looking at these ridiculous insult 0.0001 accounts and getting providers to do something about it. But alas, no.
Yes, so last year, the FCA came up with this 14-step plan to ensure that banks and building societies pass on fair value to consumers, which is part of the consumer duty stuff that you just mentioned. And part of it really is, you think about the big banks and how they are still offering really quite bad easy access rates, the majority of, and lots of people still park their cash in them, and it's still there and it's still a problem, even though in the last 18 months or so, we've seen savings rates go so much higher than what they have been over the past decade. So what the FCA said this week is that it's going on a big advertising blitz across the radio, across social media, hey, on this podcast, because we're mentioning it here, about encouraging people to switch and how easy it is. You know, so there's going to be, you know, find a, the message really is find a better savings rate in as little as 5 minutes. There's so much information out there, including on our own website, of where you can go and open best deals, best rates. And, you know, in my mind as well, savers have to go and help themselves. You know, people in general just have to go and help themselves and go and find a better rate. I'll give you an example. I opened a new cash ISA earlier in the year with Zopa. It was offering the best rate. I think it was 5.08%. Now, I needed a new home for my cash ISA anyway. I was quite interested just to see how the process went and whether it was difficult or not. It took me literally 2 minutes to open a cash ISA and fund and put money in it. I sent a test pound in there, saw it arrived, put some more money in there, and it was just super, super easy. There's no excuse, really. And I think something like this can help people, you know, push in their mind not to just accept a dud deal. It's really hard to stop the laziness of personal finances sometimes. And people go, oh, it all sounds a bit boring or a bit dull. I mean, as I say, opening that Zopa account took absolutely no time whatsoever. Now, you mentioned there about cash ISAs last year. So last year was the first real cash ISA season that we've had for a very long time. Now, what we mean by cash ISA season is typically between sort of March and May, people rush to either get a new account or max out their allowance before the new financial year rolls around. And then you get the real early birds that get the best deals right straight off the bat after April 6th and max out their allowance or start drip feeding into an ISA once again to make the most of that 20 grand allowance. We actually have some new rules coming into ISAs as well that's going to make it a bit more simplified from April, including being able to open more than an account for more than one provider and that kind of thing. So it might be that there's even more money and more interest around ISAs this year. But last year, the warning is, if you opened at a 1 year fix at the time, you are likely now to be seeing the money mature. You've had your year up. And I would say from this month onwards is this where this is really going to come to bite. But some of the rates you then get shunted onto after the 1 year fix ends is not good. So for instance, last year, Barclays actually had the best 1 year fixed rate cash ISA actually came out with a good deal. The thing is now, a year later, that drops to 1.65% from 4%, up to 10 grand. And then the balance is over 10 grand, it's 1.2%. I mean, that does not sound good. That's hundreds of pounds of interest will be lost if you do not act. And you can simply just reinvest it into another 1 year ISA with Barclays. It's better than doing nothing. And Barclays is still, it's actually offering 4.65% now as rates have gone up. It's not a best buy, but it's still better than doing nothing and it dropping down to that absolutely terrible rate. But the next one of the next best buys was Castle Trust. It had a 3.9% 1 year cash ISA. That drops to 0.1% if you roll onto its variable deal at the end of the term. That is absolutely ludicrous. We talk about Barclays being a big bank and the big banks, you know, Castle Trust is not a big bank, but it's still pulling these kind of tricks. So you've got to make sure that you move your cash. And Castle Trust, again, is offering a good rate over 1 year. It's offering one of the best rates, 5%. All you have to do, if you don't act, it will drop to 0.1%. If you act to move your money away, you can go and get a better rate. And even if you do the bare minimum, which is to act and keep the money at the same bank, but reinvest it into another 1 year, you're going to get a better rate than last year. You're not going to fall onto a terrible rate. And it takes a few minutes over the phone or even online to sort these things out. So do it. Now, the last thing I was going to mention about savings, Georgie, actually, let me just check the link to this. But next week we have This Is Money has an exclusive deal coming up, exclusive cashback deal, which will boost some rates to Best Buy levels. It's going out on Monday. If you want to be involved in that, you need to go and sign up to our savings alert service. So www.thisismoney.co.uk/savings-alert. Go and sign up there with your email address. It takes a couple of seconds. And we've got some Best Buy rates coming on Monday, Georgie. I'm excited. There's some deals that are going to blow some things out of the water. So make sure you get signed up to that.
Hurrah. Hurrah, Lee. Right. We're going to move off savings, though. We're going to talk about tipping. So you have a new regular Ask the Consumer Rights Lawyer column. Let me read this. I went to a restaurant with a group of friends and the bill had a 15% service charge. which added £52 to the total. The restaurant said it was mandatory, a mandatory charge, as we had more than 10 people in our party, but at no time were we told this would be the case. Before we get into Lee's rant about this, Ang, can I bring you in here? From the legal perspective on this one, mandatory. I mean, I thought that tipping back in the day was for good service. It doesn't appear to be like that anymore, does it? Because you have the optional stuff, which is already included in the bill, and then you have to be a bit of a one to have to say, sorry, can you take this off? I mean, I've never done that. Maybe once if it was really bad. But what are these mandatory charges?
Yeah, there definitely seems to be a move away from the optional, which I'm kind of on the fence about. I know Lee has opinions. So I think that currently the mandatory charge is you have to be told in advance of the contract being made. So this is when you're booking it. It can't be made, you know, when you get to the restaurant. So I think in this case, the person was completely within their rights to ask for a refund. But you absolutely, I mean, if you're not told beforehand, as far as I know, you can ask for it to be removed. Whether or not you choose to do that is obviously up to the person. I used to be a waitress, so I'm kind of on the fence about this. I feel like it, you know, waiters and waitresses are not paid as badly as, say, in the States. So I don't think necessarily we should be kind of topping up their wages, especially if you do get bad service. But I don't know, last weekend I went out for dinner and I just paid the service charge because I felt too awkward to not pay it. So I think it depends on who you are as a person.
What he's saying here is that if a restaurant wants to levy this compulsory service charge, it's got to tell the customer beforehand. Now, this is part of the Consumer Rights Act, and it makes it clear that key terms such as an obligation to pay a service charge must be made prominent so that the consumer is aware of them before entering into the contract, meaning before committing to the restaurant booking. Now, that what that means is that if you turn up at a restaurant and you had no idea about there being a compulsory service charge, really, they don't have a leg to stand on. Now, if you make a booking and it says there will be a compulsory service charge added to this bill, which quite often does happen if you are booking, especially for a 6 or 8 person meal, then you don't have as much of a leg to stand on because they've made it very clear on the booking that that's what is going on. But yes, I have, as Ang clearly put there, some opinions about this.
What are your views, Lee?
My views. First of all, can I just say that the hospitality industry needs all the support that you can get from us. You know, if you have a local favourite restaurant, local favourite cafe, that kind of thing, you know, great, and support them, and brilliant. And I have numerous ones, both here where I live in Essex and also near the office in Kensington. What really rankles me about this, Georgie, and I wrote something about this 11 years ago. I actually went and tracked it down in the old archives of what I was saying, because it had just started to explode at that point, the optional service charge. Now, compulsory service charge is a completely different thing. Optional service charge is one of those things that gets lumped onto your bill. And as Ang says, you feel awkward ever kind of saying, well, hold on a minute. Was the service really that good? It's quite often 12.5%. It's been imported by from the States, as Ang sort of alluded to there. But in the States, many of the states don't have minimum wage, for example. So waitresses and waiters are reliant on tips. In this country, we have a minimum wage and staff are typically paid fairly well. And I like to tip people. I like to, if it's been a good service, totally understand. But there are occasions where this optional service charge has got completely out of hand, including a local cafe to me around here. All of a sudden, I'm now having to pay on a tablet. So you hand your card over and they turn around this tablet and it's got all of these tip options. You know, press this button to put a tip, and it's just kind of like, oh, I don't know. I'd rather just give you a couple of quid cash. Like, I'm old school, I like to put it in a jar. You know, that's okay, isn't it? Like, I'm still tipping you. But it's when the optional service charge is almost in the bag, And I'll give you an example of this. And it was an example that I've seen quite a lot. I went to a bar, you know, I met at a cocktail bar. I'm standing at the bar. I'm not at a table. I'm at the bar. I'm ordering drinks. The drinks come. Waitress goes from the bar staff goes from the bar to the fridge, pours drink, brings it back to the bar, talking a couple of steps, you know, gives me the bill, optional service charge on there. What does that mean? I'm already paying
America.
I'm already paying enough for the drinks.
Did you offer to go round there to the fridge and open it up from yourself? Like, well, exactly. Save the bother.
And then I kind of said, I don't want to pay the optional service charge. And then I was told that I had to pay the optional service charge. And then
it's kind optional, then, is it?
Yeah, well, it's not optional, exactly. But then it starts to get awkward. Then you start to feel a bit silly. Then people are kind of looking at you. And it's like, how much do you like stand your ground and make yourself look like almost very un-British, isn't it? Like, we kind of do just suck things up and just go, oh, okay, let's move on.
Well, how did you stand your ground, Lee?
I didn't. Because it was quite busy. I tried to stand my ground as much as possible, and then it just got awkward. And then I just kind of said, you know what? I'll just vote with my feet and never come back in this bar.
I was going to say, would you go back again?
Which sounds really petty. It sounds really petty. And people might be listening to this going, oh, you sound petty. But that's fine. I don't mind. It's absolutely fine. But when you're talking about walking a few steps to get some drinks and come back, that makes no sense. Now, if you're talking about four of us are out for dinner, and the waiter or waitress has been super friendly, super helpful, talked you through the menu, everything's come out in a timely fashion, it's been a nice meal, yes, of course we're going to tip. Absolutely fine to tip, you know, feeling good, I've had a lovely time, lovely meal. But other times when it hasn't been so great and the service has been a bit substandard, why on earth would I be tipping? You know, yeah. it's not like you're not going to be paid well for tonight. I mean, I'm not saying that hospitality staff get paid well, but there's certainly a wage that gets paid, and optional service charges it's had a very big creep into British way of life, and I'm just not fond of it. And I will, George, I would say probably one time out of five in a restaurant or a cafe or wherever it might be, I just take the optional service charge off if I don't think it's been up to scratch. Should I feel awkward about that? Should I feel like, should that be the norm? I don't understand. Like, what's optional about it if you're going to make me feel awkward for removing it from a bill? And that's what gets me. That's what annoys me. As I say, there'll be people listening to this going, Godly, you're absolutely awful human. And when I did write this story 11 years ago, there were some people in the comments that said, you know, this is absolutely outrageous. Can't believe you're saying this. And other people were like, yeah, totally agree. So I know it's one of those kind of like Marmite things. And lots of us have worked in the hospitality industry. I've had jobs in the hospitality industry, and I got tips sometimes for stuff. But it's just become way too normal. It should, all the control should be with you. There shouldn't be a service charge. It should just be like, I've had a nice meal. You know what? I'll leave a £5 note, a £10 note, potentially, depending on what you've got. Why do we have to do it? And then, of course, the very last thing about this, which rules changed, but it still is a lot of people that go, where does that optional service charge actually go? Does it get shared out? You know, is it just going into the bottom line of a restaurant? And I think that's the other thing as well. I find it more galling doing an optional service charge at a chain restaurant or a chain place than I do at an independent. That, again, that might just be me, and that might be me not being very nice to kind of chain restaurants. But they're always such big organisations. I just wonder who's benefiting from the service charge. And that, Georgie, is me out. If you disagree with me, if you agree with me, get in touch. editor@thisismoney.co.uk, and we'll talk through some of the best responses next week. We'd love to hear from you.
I'm going to update your piece for the 2024 era and say I went to, for shame, Pizza Express the other day. Used to not mind Pizza Express when it was reasonable. Now it's just goopy grossness. But either way, you can now do everything via the app. I can order it. I can pay for it. And then at the end, it still has the service charge. And I thought, for what? Literally, I could have just, the only difference was I didn't walk over to the side and grab my dinner. But I mean,
there's quite a lot of restaurants that have started to do that now.
Coffee shops now where you put in on a board this like QR McDonald's.
Code. Here's the menu. Scan this QR code. Order here. Pay here. No, I'm at a restaurant. Yeah. I want an experience. I want to kind of say hello to a friendly waiter or waitress and have the full kit of caboodle. Otherwise, I might as well just be at home. But that's what I think that's what people are doing. They're just getting deliveries to their home. And that's what's killing a little bit the hospitality industry, because the experience in a way is getting kind of chipped away.
But they should be going the other way. Every story totally we talk about AIs and robots taking our jobs, they say you just have to be like more human. The things that are going to make you better in the future is, you know, your creativity, your humanity, all those things that hopefully AI won't be able to replicate. And this is where an experience at a restaurant to justify, because you're getting smaller dishes for a much bigger price. You know, you have to go through stupid apps and stuff. Own it, the experience. Make it a great experience for people. The other thing I'll say to this is I don't like the optional, because it's like 10%, 12% or whatever, because sometimes, and I had an amazing Uber driver when I left my phone in that came and dropped it off with me, I wanted to give them a really big tip. It didn't allow me to go above what it had suggested. So I had to give them in cash anyway. Ang, I'm so sorry.
That's a good thing. I mean, I think that's
I want to give more. I want to give more. I mean,
just very briefly, and then you're going to get back to Ang and have views on this, but we kind of spoke a little bit about this before Christmas, George, when we were talking about the experience of shopping and how self-checkouts are driving a lot of people mad. And there was a certain retailer now that just basically got rid of all of the staff and replaced it with self-scanning, where I had to take out the tags. I had to pack my own, fold the clothes, pack them in my own bag. I just ain't going back in there. I mean, it's just ridiculous. That's what I'm paying. That's built into the price of the product. I don't understand it. Where, if we don't fight back, if we don't make a stand on these kind of things, it just becomes the norm. And that's my viewpoint. Again, please feel free to disagree with me and get in touch. Now, Anne's going to tell you why she loves paying an optional service charge.
Okay, go.
No, I mean, I don't love paying it. I think especially when you've had really bad service. And it is that awkwardness. It's that sort of British thing. I do wonder if part of the kind of the option that you're given on the card reader is kind of a symptom of the death of cash. Because people, you know, maybe when it was maybe a bit more 50-50 that people were paying with cards and cash, people weren't maybe tipping as much. So companies felt like they maybe needed to give that option on cards. And now it's just become so normalised that you do just go down to your pub. You end up paying £8 for a pint or something ridiculous. So I think especially with bars and pubs, I am very anti paying service charge.
There we go. Final word to you. Right, Lee, before we leave, a quick one about Bitcoin. Jumped beyond $60,000 this week. But why? And does it mean Bitcoin is back and better than ever? I don't know, Lee.
Back and better than ever, like it's changed some sort of form and gone into some sort of different zone. Yes, Bitcoin has been on a real tear up this week. I think we can call it an official tear up. It has you look at the graph and it is to the moon this week. It has gone, I'm going to say in a word, crackers the price. So there was a day, I think it was, where are we now? So it was on Wednesday. And I was watching the price chart and it was just up and up and up to the moon. It raised from like 57,000 to 60,000. Next time I looked half an hour later, it was at 63,000, racing towards those all-time highs that were seen quite a few years ago now when it peaked towards the end of 2021. Very, very close to that mark now. It hit for a very brief amount of time. It kind of hit above 65,000. We're currently on about $62,000 a coin. There's two reasons why Bitcoin has been on this kind of bullish run. And actually, Ang's written about this quite extensively. But the first thing is the spot Bitcoin ETFs were given US regulatory approval. Now, what that means is people can get involved in exchange traded funds of Bitcoin, which basically opened up the crypto markets to billions of dollars of fresh capital. But there's still lots of people that are on the fence. For example, UBS said that the investment case for digital assets remains weak. There's lots of people that are very polarized over cryptocurrency versus physical money, which involves centralized banks and the way that fresh money is printed. And you'll have real advocates that just think that digital currency and the way that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies work through the blockchain are the future of money and the future of finance. And then you just get basically a big blob of people in the middle that go, not really too sure what Bitcoin is, not really too sure what cryptocurrency is, but I want to be involved just in case this does go to the moon, this does go to $100,000 a coin or $500,000 a coin or $1 million a coin and miss out. Now, the big reason for that is just how quickly it raced up. And we all read the stories of people that had made a fortune out of cryptocurrency, got involved early, sold out at the peak. Lots of people almost see it as that kind of easy way to make some money, but you have to tread with absolute caution. The first thing, you know, to say about if you want to get involved with crypto and Bitcoin is just to go and do lots of reading about it, try and get as much of an understanding about how it works, how blockchain works and how all the different cryptos work. It's never been easier to get involved. You know, somewhere like Coinbase is pretty simple to sort of get involved and invest in it. The other reason that we are seeing Bitcoin prices kind of rise. Now, I'm going to try and explain this, but it's a little bit complicated, but it isn't and it isn't. So it is and it isn't. So there's a halving event coming in April. Now, these halving events happen from time to time. And what it does is it sees the reward for mining Bitcoin fall by half. Therefore, it reduces the supply of fresh Bitcoin coming to market and, in theory, boosts the value of those already in existence as a result. There could be a big boom in April, Georgie, off the back of this, which is what we have seen in the past. But you have to be very careful about who you listen to. There's some people that are incredibly bullish on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and really do think that the sky is the limit. Then there'll be lots of people that just go, this isn't the future of money whatsoever, and there's lots of foibles to it. And if you're going to get involved, make it a very, very, very small part of your portfolio. Again, lots of people got burnt by just going 100% crypto. You know, there was obviously that big case which really rocked the market. FTX?
FTX.
You know, that really rocked the world of cryptocurrency. Lots of people got burnt off the back of that. And we saw Bitcoin really fall to the floor from the peaks. So, as I say, if you're going to get involved, tread very cautiously. Don't make it a huge part of your portfolio. Things, the way it's been going this week, and the more mainstream ETF sort of investment options seem to be really sort of putting a rocket under the price. The halving event again could be something else that adds some more value to it. Wouldn't be surprised to see it go past the all-time highs. Also wouldn't be surprised to see it plummet back down to earth. It's one of those things. It's incredibly volatile at times. At times it's not volatile, but at other times there's so much trading of it and people, you know, selling out and buying in. It's just it has weeks like this where it's just a roller coaster ride, and that's why I would say tread with extreme caution.
Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee.
Yeah, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can also comment in the comment section of where this podcast will live.
Marvellous. If you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.